The Most Dangerous Lie in Modern Economics. Welcome to this audio issue of Porter's Daily Journal, published and copyrighted by Porter & Company, all rights reserved. Please note that this recording was generated via AI and may contain minor transcription errors and pronunciation mistakes. Throughout this issue, I may reference charts, graphs, and imagery that can only be viewed on our website at porterandcompanyresearch.com. Issue number 52. Volume number 3. Men and women aren't the same. Ignoring this reality is destroying our nation. Inside today's Daily Journal. Essay: The Most Dangerous Lie in Modern Economics. Housing sales tumble, central banks load up on gold, Nike insider buying chart of the day. Eli Lilly, LLY. Today's mailbag editor's note. Today's journal essay was written by Shannon Stansberry. Shannon holds a Bachelor of Science in Civil Engineering from Dalhousie University in Halifax, Nova Scotia. Shannon and Porter are expecting their first child, a girl, in June. Every great civilization was built on specialization, not equality, not sameness, not the idea that everyone should do everything. Specialization, the deliberate, rational division of labor based on what each participant does best. Adam Smith explained this clearly in 1776. He opened The Wealth of Nations, arguably the most important economics text ever written, with the now famous example of a pin factory: one worker drawing the wire, another straightening it, a third cutting it, a fourth pointing it, 10 workers, each performing a specialized task, could produce 48,000 pins per day. A single worker trying to do it all? Maybe 10 if he was really good. That's not a 10x improvement. That's a 4,800x improvement. Adam Smith's insight wasn't just about factories. It was about the fundamental architecture of prosperity. When people specialize in what they do best and trade with each other, total output explodes. David Ricardo, writing in 1817, extended Smith's idea into what became the most important theorem in economics: comparative advantage. Ricardo proved, mathematically, that even if one party is better at everything than the other, both parties are still made wealthier by specializing and trading. Let me say that again, because most people don't understand it. Even if you are superior in every single skill, you are still made richer by focusing on the skill where your relative advantage is greatest and letting someone else handle the rest. This is not an opinion. This is not a philosophy. It is a mathematical certainty. In 1992, Gary Becker won the Nobel Prize in Economics for applying exactly this principle to the household. Becker demonstrated that the family unit operates like a small firm, and that when household members specialize according to their comparative advantages, the household produces more total wealth than when members attempt to perform identical roles. Smith, Ricardo, Becker, three of the greatest economic minds in human history, spanning 216 years, all arrived at the same conclusion. Specialization creates wealth. Duplication destroys it. And yet, over the past 60 years, American society has conducted a massive, unprecedented experiment in despecialization. We've told men and women that they should perform identical roles, in the workplace, in the home, in every dimension of economic life. We've called this progress. The data says otherwise. Here's what actually happened. In 1960, the vast majority of American households operated on a specialization model. One partner, typically the husband, specialized in generating income. The other partner, typically the wife, specialized in household production, raising children, maintaining the home, coordinating the family's logistics, building community relationships, and managing consumption decisions that directly impacted the household's wealth. This was not, as modern critics love to claim, one person working while the other stayed home. This was two people performing highly specialized, complementary economic functions. The household was a production unit, and it was enormously productive. Here are the numbers. The personal savings rate in America averaged 11.7% of disposable income throughout the 1960s and 1970s, peaking at 17.3% in May 1975. The household debt-to-income ratio in 1960 was 0.55, meaning American families owed about 55 cents for every dollar of disposable income they earned. Families owned their homes. They saved for retirement. They built generational wealth. And they did it on a single income. Now look at today. As of early 2025, the personal savings rate has collapsed to 4.4%. That's not a modest decline. That's the end of financial independence for virtually every household in America. And household debt? The debt-to-income ratio peaked at nearly 1.2 in 2008, $1.20 in debt for every dollar of disposable income, more than double the 1960 level. Even after the post-crisis deleveraging, it sits around 0.82 today. Americans owe 82 cents for every dollar of disposable income. Their grandparents owed 55 cents. Here's the irony that no one talks about. This savings collapse happened during the most dramatic increase in household income in American history. Median household income, adjusted for inflation, rose from $66,000 in 1968 to over $80,000 by 2023. We're earning more than ever before, but saving less than at any point since the Great Depression. How is that possible? While Ricardo's law is a mathematical certainty, we must ask why comparative advantages tend to fall along certain lines. Modern ideologues insist these roles were socially constructed or forced, but their claims don't change the physical, hormonal, or intellectual differences between men and women. Biology is the ultimate driver of economic reality, as my husband's forthcoming investment strategy, the Financial Sorcerer's Stone, will demonstrate next week. The household is not just a firm, it is a biological unit. Women are psychologically and biologically designed to be home specialists, possessing a unique comparative advantage in the domestic sphere that no amount of corporate lean in culture can replicate. This is not a limitation. It is a specialized skill. From a neurobiological perspective, women generally possess higher levels of oxytocin and a greater aptitude for emotional intelligence and soft infrastructure management. These aren't just nice traits, they are the essential tools for human capital development. A mother's wiring for empathy and multitasking makes her the most efficient manager of a child's early development and the home's social stability. When we ignore these innate differences, we force women into a competition with men in the workplace that is often not in their best interest. Men, biologically driven by higher testosterone and a psychological leaning toward hierarchy and risk, are wired for the hyper-competitive, often impersonal environments of the market. To demand that a woman compete on those same terms is to ask her to trade her highest value specialization, the home, for a role where her comparative advantage is neutralized by a masculine-coded environment. The standard narrative goes like this: women entered the workforce, household income doubled, and everyone got richer. The actual math tells a very different story. When both partners in a household enter the workforce full-time, the household doesn't just gain a second income. It incurs a cascading series of new costs that didn't exist under the specialization model. Childcare. The average cost of daycare in America is now $13,254 per child per year. In states like Massachusetts, it tops $22,000. A family with two young children can easily spend $26,000 to $45,000 per year just on warehousing their kids. Under the old model, this cost was zero. The total cost of raising a child until they can attend public school, 5 years old, now averages $27,743 per year when you include food, transportation, healthcare, and childcare costs. These costs are growing much faster than the government's reported inflation. And then there's taxes. The household's second income doesn't arrive tax-free. A household earning $80,000 on one income keeps more of each marginal dollar than a household earning $80,000 split between two $40,000 earners. Because of progressive tax brackets, payroll taxes on both incomes, and the loss of certain deductions and credits. The commute. Two commuters also means two cars, two insurance policies, two sets of maintenance, fuel, tolls, and parking. The average cost of owning and operating a vehicle in America today exceeds $12,000 per year. Combined, the childcare, the taxes, the second car, the outsourced meals, the services, and the net economic gain from that second income is a fraction of the gross. In many cases, particularly for households earning below the median, the second income barely breaks even after expenses. But the household has lost something more valuable than the money. It has lost its specialist. The liberation of women into the workforce often looks more like a transfer of labor from a domain where women held sovereign authority, the home, to one where they are replaceable cogs in a corporate machine. This is the part that modern economists refuse to quantify, because it demolishes the narrative. The stay-at-home mom wasn't idle. She was performing the economic function that every successful enterprise requires: operational management of the production unit. Think about it like a business. What would happen to a company if it fired its full-time CFO and replaced that person with a consultant who showed up for two distracted hours after 6 p.m.? That's what we've done to the American household. The household specialist managed consumption optimization, shopping for value, cooking meals from raw ingredients, eliminating waste. A skilled household manager could feed a family of four on a fraction of what two exhausted professionals spend on takeout and convenience food. Financial management: tracking, spending, managing savings, paying bills on time, avoiding late fees and interest charges, negotiating with service providers, filing insurance claims. Human capital development: raising children with direct parental attention rather than institutional daycare. The research on this is overwhelming. Children raised with consistent parental presence show better outcomes in academic achievement, emotional regulation, and long-term earning potential. Maintenance and asset management: maintaining the home, managing repairs, or performing them, preserving the household's largest asset. Deferred maintenance compounds like bad debt. Every year you neglect a house, the repair bill grows exponentially. Social capital: building and maintaining community relationships, neighbors, schools, churches, local institutions, that create the network of mutual support and opportunity that used to define American civic life. None of these family needs disappeared when the specialists left. They were either abandoned or they were outsourced at market rates to strangers who have no stake in the household's long-term prosperity. So who actually benefits? Here's the question nobody asks. If the family isn't wealthier, if the savings rate has collapsed, if debt has doubled, if the net gain from that second income is marginal at best, then who is getting rich from this arrangement? The answer is simple. Follow the money. The winner is the federal government. When you double the labor force, you double the tax base. Women's labor force participation rose from 37% in 1960 to 61% by 1997. Federal revenue didn't just grow, it exploded. Every second earner who enters the workforce generates payroll taxes, income taxes, and consumption taxes on every dollar of outsourced household function. The government doesn't care whether the family is building wealth. It cares that both adults are generating taxable income. The same people who told women that entering the workforce was liberation are the same government agencies that profit from the destruction of the self-sufficient household. The family went from producing wealth internally to consuming services externally. Every dollar of that consumption is someone else's revenue. The family got poorer. The government got richer. That's not a coincidence. But the financial damage, as devastating as it isn't the worst outcome for families. The despecialization of the American household hasn't just destroyed wealth. It's destroying the family itself. And the data on this is so stark that it borders on civilizational emergency. Fertility has collapsed. The total U.S. fertility rate in 1960 was 3.53 births per woman. Today it is 1.62. That's a 54% decline, and it puts America well below the population replacement level of 2.1 children per woman. We are not replacing ourselves. In 2024, there were 44.2 million women aged 20 to 39 in the United States. Of those, 23.1 million, 52%, had not given birth. According to the Carsey School of Public Policy, there are now 5.7 million more childless women of prime childbearing age than would have been expected given fertility patterns before the Great Recession. The result, 11.8 million fewer babies born over the past 17 years than demographic models predicted. Among women aged 40 to 44, those at the end of their childbearing years, the share who have never had a child rose from 10% in 1976 to 18% in 2008, an 80% increase in a single generation. And it's only gotten worse since. Why? Because you can't defer childbearing indefinitely in favor of career advancement and then expect biology to cooperate. Female fertility declines measurably after age 30 and drops sharply after 35. One in seven couples is infertile at ages 30 to 34. One in four is infertile at ages 40 to 44. ART, assisted reproductive technology, usage has more than doubled since 2012, a booming industry built on the biological reality that career timelines and fertility windows are fundamentally incompatible. Marriages are fracturing. Data compiled from the Census Bureau's American Community Survey, 2012 to 23, reveals that when a woman is the household's primary earner, the annual divorce rate, that's how many divorces occur per year, is three times higher than in marriages where the man earns more, 31 per 1,000 versus 11 per 1,000. In single-income households with a female breadwinner, the rate is even worse, 54 per 1,000. Female breadwinners represent just 16% of all U.S. households, but account for 42% of all divorces. University of Chicago economist Marianne Bertrand found that a wife outturning her husband causes measurable unhappiness in the relationship and increases the probability of marital dissolution. This isn't only happening in America. A 2024 analysis of French couples found that when the woman's share of income exceeds 55%, the couple is 40% more likely to break up. In 1968, 85% of American children lived with both parents. Today, that number is 70%. The share of children living only with their mothers has nearly doubled, from 11% to 21%. And infidelity? When you put men and women in proximity for 40 hours per week, with shared goals, shared stress, shared accomplishments, and limited time at home with their actual partners, what do you think happens? Exactly what you would expect. 85% of extramarital affairs begin in the workplace. Of those who've had a workplace romance, 40% admit to cheating on their existing partner with a colleague. Nearly 1 in 10 U.S. workers, 9.78%, reported having a workplace affair in the past 12 months alone. Among men specifically, 10.63% admitted to cheating with a colleague in just the past 6 months. When both spouses spend the majority of their waking hours in separate workplaces, building emotional bonds with colleagues, sharing intellectual pursuits, experiencing daily victories and frustrations together, the marriage doesn't receive those hours. Those hours are gone. The emotional energy is spent elsewhere. And the statistical result is exactly what you'd expect. Fewer marriages. More divorce. More infidelity. Fewer children. And the children who do arrive are raised by institutions rather than parents. This is not progress. This is the systematic dismantling of the most effective social institution humanity has ever created. Let me bring this back to economist David Ricardo, because this is the part that matters most. Ricardo's law of comparative advantage does not say that one party is better and the other is worse. That's not what comparative advantage means. It means that total output is maximized when each party focuses on the activity where their relative opportunity cost is lowest. Applied to the household, if one partner can earn $100,000 per year in the labor market, and the other can earn $45,000, the household does not maximize output by having both earn $145,000 gross, and then spending $40,000 on childcare, $12,000 on a second car, another $15,000 on outsourced household functions, and paying higher marginal tax rates on the combined income. The household maximizes output by having the higher earner specialize in market income and the other partner specialize in household production, eliminating $67,000 in costs, managing consumption, and building the long-term capital, human, financial, and social, that sustains the family's wealth across generations. But here's what modern culture has made it impossible to say. In the majority of households, across the majority of human history, the comparative advantages did break along gender lines, and not because of oppression, but because of preference, specialized abilities, and the biological reality of who bears children. The economic results of honoring these comparative advantages were extraordinary. The savings rate tells the financial story. But the real destruction is cultural. When both parents work full-time, the household ceases to function as a wealth-building production unit and becomes a consumption machine. There is no one optimizing the family's resource allocation. No one is building social capital in the community. No one is investing focused attention in the children's development. The result? Americans are richer in gross income and poorer in net wealth, happiness, community, and generational stability than at any point in modern history. Adam Smith understood this. David Ricardo would have proved it with a single equation. Gary Becker won a Nobel Prize explaining exactly why. But we stopped listening to economists and started listening to ideologues, government propagandists, who told us that the sexes are interchangeable and that specialization is oppression. As I'm sure you've seen with families who have abandoned traditional gender roles, the real destruction is not just in the bank account, but in the soul. We have traded the most successful economic unit in history, the specialized household, for the illusion that two incomes equals twice as rich. And we've lost far more than money. By ignoring the psychological and biological strengths that women bring to the domestic sphere, we haven't made women freer. We have made the household poorer. We have replaced a symbiotic partnership with a competitive one. Specialization is the engine of prosperity. It's time we stopped pretending that the sexes are interchangeable and started honoring the unique, indispensable roles that make a home a powerhouse of production rather than a mere site of consumption. Tell us what you think of today's journal. PorterStansberryDirect@gmail.com. Good investing. Shannon Stansberry Stevenson, Maryland. Three things to know before we go. 1. The housing market approaches 2008 lows. Housing units under construction have declined sharply since 2024, and sales of existing U.S. homes are down 35% from their pandemic peak, at less than 4 million sales over the last 12 months. That's approaching the lowest level since 2010, in the aftermath of the housing bust following the 2008 financial crisis. We're approaching a generational low in the U.S. housing market, and that means a generational low in what Porter has called the Sorcerer's Stone, an enormous natural energy reserve powering past housing booms. 2. Central banks load up on gold. The global appetite for gold shows no signs of slowing down, as central banks snapped up 19 net tons in February, marking nearly 2 years of consecutive monthly purchases. Leading the charge, the National Bank of Poland bolstered its reserves, bringing gold to 31% of its total holdings, while Uzbekistan added 8 tons, pushing its gold-to-reserve ratio to 88%. China extended its buying streak to 17 straight months with its largest purchase in over a year, and the Czech Republic marked its 36th consecutive month of net buying. With year-to-date purchases already sitting at 25 tons, it is clear that gold remains the preferred anchor for nations looking to shore up their balance sheets in an increasingly volatile world. 3. Nike Insider doubles down. Former Intel CEO and Nike, NKE, Audit Committee Chair Bob Swan bought 11,781 NKE shares on April 7, a $500,000 open market purchase that increased his position 27%. He joined CEO Elliott Hill in a rare cluster of insider buying. Despite its sluggish share price performance, Nike's wholesale recovery and margin expansion are slowly gaining traction. Clearly those who are watching the turnaround firsthand agree. Chart of the day. Same day delivery for Eli Lilly weight loss pill. Amazon Pharmacy has begun offering Foundayo, Eli Lilly's, LLY, newly approved once daily oral GLP-1, via same day delivery in nearly 3,000 cities. Pricing starts at just $25 per month with insurance. This is a significant distribution win for Lilly. Getting a weight loss drug into patients' hands the day they see a doctor eliminates the biggest friction point in GLP-1 adoption, the wait. LLY shares are up 20% since we recommended them to complete investor subscribers in June 2025. Mailbag Capital Mischief Daniel J. writes, "Run Don't Walk to Read Substack Capital Mischief, The $2 Million Lie." It talks about how private credit is preying on, guess whose retirement accounts. My takeaway, one major part is that insurance companies, instead of investing their floats in ZERP treasuries, invested in private credit. The article does not mention any companies that your letters have advocated. However, only Warren Buffett is still famous, laughed at for holding more treasuries than the Fed. The other companies are dead men walking. As Warren says, when the tide comes in, we will see who is swimming naked. My question is simple. Are the numbers of our insurance companies legit? Porter comment. I expect the losses related to private credit to be concentrated in life insurance companies because they have long duration liabilities. The insurance companies that we recommend, property and casualty insurance, have short duration liabilities, policies that renew annually, and thus invest almost exclusively in publicly traded fixed income. How to approach. F. Chaplin writes, I have strong interests in gold and energy investments. I currently have $0 in the market but have money to put into it. With the chatter of an upcoming crash and major energy crisis, I have been holding back to get in at the lowest prices, but is it better to wait and be patient or to go ahead and invest in high-quality gold and energy companies, despite a potential crash, believing these stocks will quickly rebound? Porter comment. We haven't altered our official allocation in the permanent portfolio. We see a very high likelihood that inflation will trend much higher this year, potentially pushing long-term interest rates higher. As we've said repeatedly, we see the risk of a stagflation, and in that scenario, I would expect the indexes to fall roughly 50%, but that hasn't happened yet, so our threshold is 5% on the 10-year yield. About a month ago, we recommended buying energy hedges in the case of a prolonged Persian Gulf shutdown, and if you've taken those hedges, you've done very well. We've also recommended that investors who are retired or who don't want to stomach a 20% drawdown to raise additional cash by selling out of the property and causality insurance allocation of the portfolio. Uber Bailey T. writes, curious of your thoughts on the recent announcement of Uber's investment into electric car maker Rivian. Does this change your thoughts on their future success by adding significant capital cost to their asset-light model? Thanks for your response in advance. Porter comment, the evolution of artificial intelligence, AI, marginally weakens the moat around all pure software businesses. By adding iron, cars, to its balance sheet, Uber probably strengthens its moat. Please note, the investments in our Porter & Company top positions should not be considered current recommendations. These positions are the best performers across our publications, and the securities listed may, or may not, be above the current buy-up to price. To learn more, visit the current recommendations page of the relevant service, here. To gain access or to learn more about our current recommendations, call our customer care team at 888-610-8895 or internationally at +1-443-815-4447. Thank you for being a paid subscriber to Porter & Company. We hope you enjoyed this audio issue.